Yesterday, a flurry of leadership speculation capped off a rough week for the Liberal Party. Disgruntled backbencher Sarah Henderson said Susan Lee was losing support. That may be true, but there's little appetite to topple the leader right now. Both moderates and conservatives were quick to hose down any talk of a challenge. Their priority is sorting out the internal mess over climate policy. The party of Menzies is now deciding what it wants to be. Does it follow the Nationals and dump the net zero by 2050 emissions target, or stick with some sort of climate ambition to win back lost voters in the cities? On Wednesday, Liberal MPs will gather here in Canberra to thrash this out.
The Federal Coalition has again made itself the story.
You want to talk about the Liberal Party, I guess?
Absolutely.
The Coalition is now one step closer to finally settling its position on net zero.
We've made our decision and now it's up to the Liberal Party.
Here's my lovely, gorgeous National Party colleague who I love dearly.
I'll sit down with the Nationals and we'll work out a coalition position together.
Net zero is not the only way to address climate change.
How much longer can the nation go on without a viable opposition?
The fact is that we are focused on cost of living. Those opposite are just focused on each other.
Susan Lee will be required to unite the party behind her with this decision.
Can Susan Lee's leadership survive?
With respect, this is actually not about me.
It is killing season.
There's renewed speculation around Susan Lee's future as leader of the Liberal Party.
I do think Susan is losing support.
I value every single member of my team.
It sounds like you're not supporting her position as leader.
Well, I can't back in the way things are.
Do you feel the same way?
No, I don't.
I'm not sensing any momentum towards wanting to change the leader of the party right now.
Are you planning to roll her?
Absolutely not.
I just don't think there's any appetite.
I do love a good green curry with a bit of spice to it.
Putative Liberal leaders Angus Taylor and Andrew Hastie sitting down with others for a Thai meal on Monday.
I do, as all of us should do, talk to my colleagues all the time about lots of issues.
I think that there's a lot of white noise that's not giving her clear air.
Things are dire at the moment and I can't pretend that things are going well. I'm not going to comment on commentary.
They're very strong, very young.
Everyone of my team is absolutely united.
That it clearly isn't united on net zero.
The Liberal Party will return here on Wednesday to thrash out their net zero policy.
A debate that has been very public will finally happen privately.
Until we sort that out, it doesn't matter who leads the party.
The energy policy has been a significant challenge.
Next week they're going to debate whether they believe in climate change again.
I said when I became leader that we would not have a policy that was net zero at any cost.
With the Nationals pulling the pin on net zero, where does this leave the Liberals?
When we meet on Wednesday to talk about our energy policy, I know that that will be a very important moment in our party.
I commend Susan for bringing us together to resolve our net zero policies. Thank you.
Have you spoken to Sarah Henderson?
My guest this morning is Shadow Housing Minister and leading Liberal moderate Andrew Bragg. First, let's check what's making news. Both Sydney papers have splashed with a police bungle that gave the all clear for a neo-Nazi rally to take place yesterday outside State Parliament. The police commissioner says there was a communications error. The Premier has ordered a review saying the rally should not have gone ahead. In the Nine newspapers, Paul Sakal reports the Liberal Party's election review will reject introducing quotas to boost the number of women in Parliament. After becoming leader, Susan Lee said she was open to quotas, but the review, led by party elders Nick Minchin and Prue Goward, has shunned the idea. The Liberal Party has just 6 women in the lower house. Meanwhile, the opposition leaders told News Corp papers the party's process for settling a net zero position may look messy, but she makes no apology for giving everyone a say. Susan Lee says that's not the way things worked under Peter Dutton. And across the papers, tributes for Graham Richardson, the former Labor minister, power broker and commentator who died yesterday morning. He's being remembered for his achievements as Environment Minister and his ability to work the numbers as the ultimate Labor machine man, along with the odd controversy. I'll have a bit more to say about Richo later on. We're going to start, though, with the Liberal Party's looming decision on net zero. This is a critical moment for the Conservative side of politics, torn over the direction it should pursue. Liberals are almost certain to drop the 2050 target. The debate now is over maintaining some sort of reference to a net zero ambition in the second half of the century. Either way, it's an end to bipartisan support for the commitment the Morrison government signed Australia up to, and a big gamble for a party which suffered its worst election result only 6 months ago. Let's see what the panel makes of it. We're joined this week by Patricia Karvelas, John Keogh and Jason Katsoukas. Very good morning to all of you. PK, just set the scene for us here. Where are things at within the party, between the moderates and the Conservatives, and where is this likely to land?
Well, what's really interesting, David, is that before the Nationals met and came to their position to oppose full stop, net zero, get rid of the word, junk the whole concept, the Liberals actually were very much moving towards a deal, like the Conservatives and the moderates. The moderates had actually given away quite a lot, in my view, including, you know, that it'd be an aspiration to get to net zero. So that already actually moved quite significantly. Then everything changed after the Nationals came to that position, which I think is quite, like, you know, controversial in many ways for the look of the Liberal Party. And the Conservatives switched. Some leading Conservatives went harder. They're pushing for net zero to go full stop. And I think we are now in a pretty fundamental and existential battle, because to get rid of... It's just two words. Mm. In some ways, it's like an episode of Seinfeld. We're having, like, two words. It's like a linguistic debate. Like, the policy is not actually what they're debating. It's language. Mm. But the language is potent, because the language is like a bushfire in the regions. And it seems to me there will be a huge division. The Conservatives look like they're going to hold the line, though. Net zero must go.
Yeah, I think that's well put, though, that it's come down to the language around these two words. Of course, it means more than just the language. It has meaning. It feels like the moderates have also shifted. They're willing to let go net zero by 2050. And it's now this debate, John, about do you have some sort of 2050 ambition in the second half of the century?
Yeah, I think that's what it's going to boil down to. But I think increasingly within the Liberal Party, let alone the coalition, net zero 2050 has just become untenable for a couple of reasons. You look at their supporter base, the Liberal Party branches, the Institute of Public Affairs, Advance Australia, the right-wing activist group, Sky News After Dark. They're all against it. Mm. And so I think even within the Liberal Party room, what's left of it, the MPs, it was most of them, let alone, did not really believe it in their DNA, their bone of bones, net zero 2050. And then you look what's happened internationally as well. It's changed since 2021 when Scott Morrison committed to it. Mm. Joe Biden was in the White House then. Donald Trump's in the White House now. He's pulled out of Paris. Mark Carney in Canada has withdrawn a carbon tax, even though he's a pro-climate leader. The UK Conservatives have dropped net zero as well. As one Liberal said to me this week, back in 2021, it was in the aftermath of bushfires. There was a lot of pressure on them to commit to it. I don't feel they feel the same pressure now.
I just want to pick up on one thing you said there. Those who are left in the Liberal Party room that are going to be making this decision, because they did lose a lot of MPs in urban seats at the election and the election before that. I was keen to see what they might argue were they given the chance this week. And I got a comment from Keith Wallahan. He held the seat of Menzies in Melbourne, one of those who lost the seats. They now hold very, very few urban seats. Here's what he told me last night. He says, look, two-thirds of the target seats needed to form government are metro. Half of the top 40 target seats are metro Melbourne and Sydney alone. There is a legitimate debate on energy, but there's another on tone, he says. Ditching two words as a 25-year aspiration sends a message we don't care about what they care about. There's no Florida or Texas to make up for that. We must win 20 city seats, and this is a high risk. Jason, it's not a bad point.
It's not a bad point, but I think a lot of Liberals and a lot of Nationals look especially to countries like the UK, where following this, the breakdown in consensus on net zero, we've seen public support in those countries for net zero drop quite markedly. I think there is a hope that once the consensus breaks down here among Conservatives, we'll see voters go with the with Conservatives, who are saying net zero is just too expensive. It's going to cost your hip pocket far too much.
So this is the question. Does dropping net zero help your hip pocket? Does it bring down power prices?
Well, not in the short term, because I think however we rebuild the energy system, it's going to be incredibly expensive. Coal-fired power is getting towards the end of its life. And I think if you look at credible, objective numbers, whether we're doing it renewables, gas, fossil fuels, nuclear, it's in the vicinity of $400 to $600 billion, no matter how you rebuild the energy system. That's ultimately going to be passed on to consumers or taxpayers in some shape or form.
And this is the fundamental issue, right? Labor needs to nail that argument. I don't think they have yet. They're letting the Liberals eat themselves, which, you know, I get that. I would too. But they've got to nail the line that under no scenario are your bills going down. It's just not happening, people. And I think the public kind of sort of accepts that in some ways. No one likes it, but I do think there is broadly a kind of radical acceptance that this is where our bills are at. I think, though, for the Liberal Party, a point that was made, I thought, so powerfully Friday by Rasheena Campbell, who ran in the by-election for Aston, is now Deputy Lord Mayor in Melbourne. But, you know, a Liberal that should be in the party room if they want to have diversity, women, like, you know, a really rich party room. She said this is generational suicide, essentially, that if they dump net zero with that many Gen Z voters going onto the electoral roll, with that many millennials on the electoral roll, it is insanity, because whether you like it or not, the symbolism of getting rid of net zero is that you do not care about climate change. Now, the Liberals will contest that, but that's how the public sees it. Ask anyone who's a teenager in their 20s, they laugh at this. They think that this is an absurd debate. And I think it's very dangerous for the Liberal Party if they go there.
What we've not heard yet from the Liberals, or indeed from the Nationals, is how they plan to get those prices down. Dan Tehan, the Shadow Energy Minister who's been steering this process, has argued this morning on Sky News one thing that they would do is sweat the existing coal assets further.
We need to make sure that we're sweating those coal assets, continue to sweat those coal assets, and also that we can get more gas into the system much more quickly.
But this, you know, some states are already trying to sweat those assets further. There's only so far you can go in stringing out more power from what are ageing coal-fired power stations.
Well, I think what voters hear when Dan Tehan says things like that is that they really are sceptical of the science behind climate change. And I don't think it helps when you have people like Tony Abbott, the former Liberal Party leader, who's out there saying that he thinks climate change is absolute crap. And I think there is this sense that underneath all of this kind of rhetoric, the Liberals don't really believe in the science of climate change. And that's the dominant theme, yeah. I think.
I mean, they contest that. They're arguing, of course, oh, no, we are credible. We want to reduce emissions. Remember, they're all arguing that we're going to continue to reduce emissions. But I think the stakes are really high. And this debate has been had so many times within that party that there is actually voter fatigue over them talking about this again. Don't forget about that.
And just on this, I mean, yes, there is voter fatigue around this whole debate, no question. And it's fair
and journo
to say,
fatigue.
And journo fatigue here and there. But the coalition is a long way from being back in government. But why does this matter, this break, as it's going to be, a break in bipartisanship on reaching net zero by 2050? You talk to senior people in the government, they know this matters. You know, sure, they're loving watching their opponents, you know, tear themselves apart. But, John, without that bipartisanship, that matters. That will shift some of the national debate.
It will. I mean, it'll probably send a bit of a signal internationally, also to investors as well. These are long-term projects, so at the margin it may discourage some investment in renewables, even though it looks like the Liberals are going to be in opposition for at least the next 5 or 6 years. These are long-term projects. But I think this, if they do abandon net zero, it's going to be a fascinating test, because politically, the Conservatives are saying, we've never really argued properly, strongly against net zero. We've never really challenged Labor on it. We've been playing on their territory. And so if they do dump it and fight harder against Labor's climate and energy policies, they're going to finally get their test to see if that argument stacks up or if it fails.
Yeah, no, exactly.
And this look, you know, this example of The Voice, you know, the referendum that you know, that question enjoyed high public support when it was a bipartisan
question.
As soon as that broke, support dropped much. rapidly, and that's, I think, something Matt Canavan in particular looks to as an example of how this could repeat itself.
There are some big differences, though. I mean, it was the conservative side of politics that signed Australia up to this. They're all on the... Well, not all of them, but plenty of the senior figures are on the record, including Susan Lee, about why we need to go to net zero.
Look, the fact that the moderates had moved so much already and still it's not enough, right? Like, because I think the moderates did the most compromise to dump, actually, you know, being wedded to this, but talk about it as an aspiration, and it's still not good enough. I mean, it's quite extraordinary that some of the Conservatives are not giving them enough leeway to even campaign in metropolitan Sydney and Melbourne on this. Like, that's wild, isn't it? And you know, Roisin was saying, like, forget Goldstein, forget Kooyong. Like, these are seats that are just now finished. Like, I really believe that. I just think there is no credibility in those seats if they take this position.
What about leadership? We saw Sarah Henderson on Friday. Susan Lee is losing support. It didn't really snowball into much, though. On both the Conservative and moderate side, it was pretty clear publicly and privately, no, now's not the time to open that up. Feels like anything could happen, but there's no great appetite, PK, right now to blow it up.
No, there isn't actually a very fixed view from even the Conservative wing to give her more time. I think they know that there is a high cost to rolling your first female leader in 6 months.
Absolutely.
Especially when she's actually, whatever people say about her, she's actually honoured what she said she would do, which is go through the process, let it be ground up, don't be top down, contrast with Peter Dutton, who was very much captain's calls and picks, and that was the way he operated. So that's the framing.
Also, would any of the other blokes who want the job want to be leading the show through this coming week? It's going to be diabolical.
They want to keep their hands clean.
Absolutely.
And also, you know, don't men love cricket over summer? Like, there's stuff they want to do, OK?
I'm sure that's
Sorry,
true.
But it's true.
Well, Andrew Hastie is someone, of course, who is keen on the leadership down the track, but even he said Friday that, no, right now, it's not his priority.
The thing we have to do is come to a position on net zero, and that's my singular focus. Until we sort that out, it doesn't matter who leads the party.
And that's probably right. What do you think? Anything going to happen on the leadership front this year, or is it a next year question?
Well, I agree, probably not this year. I think what's alarming, though, for Susan Lee is the lack of respect that is being shown to her by her backbench and even by some frontbenchers. The lack of authority that she seems to have over the party room. Because what we're seeing is people talking about whatever they want to talk about. And there's a real lack of discipline there in terms of the message that the coalition is sending out. And I think that's a real problem for Susan Lee.
No, I think that's probably right. Well, time to talk to the Shadow Housing Minister, Andrew Bragg. And to take us there, here was his colleague, Senator Henderson, arguing the Liberals should reject net zero in its entirety.
I think that most of my colleagues are now moving in a very strong direction, and that is to reject Labor's net zero policies. They are causing enormous economic and environmental harm. They are driving up power prices. And I think if we reject net zero in its entirety and we demonstrate our conviction, our belief and our fight for the Australian people, we can rise and really do a lot better into the future.
Andrew Bragg, welcome to the program.
Good morning, David.
Should the Liberal Party dump net zero in its entirety, as Sarah Henderson says there?
Well, David, the Australian people are worried about climate change, and so are we. And that's why I would have thought that the most reasonable position here would be to stay in Paris, maintain a commitment to do a better job on net zero than Labor, and maintain a goal. Because I think if you have anything less than that, then you are giving up on the idea that you will try and reduce emissions for future generations. And after all, we are the trustees for future generations.
So just so I understand your position, you're happy to give away net zero by 2050, but you want to maintain net zero as a goal in some part of the second half of this century?
Well, of course, because that is the international standard on emissions reduction. You can't create your own standard. And in terms of the date, I don't think even experts like Grattan and the ANU think that Labor will get there at 2050. So I think that's a debate we need to have about the exact date.
And look, the Paris Agreement itself does say member countries should aim to, quote, achieve a balance between emissions and removals in the second half of this century. So is some sort of net zero commitment, be it in the second half of the century, is that, in your view, a requirement of remaining in the Paris Agreement?
Well, as you say, it's in the text of the agreement, so I don't see how you can create your own standard. I mean, we're all in this together as an international community. Of course, Australia should set its own domestic rules, but the real enemy here has been Labor's attempt to reform the electricity system. I mean, that's what is causing higher power prices. It's not the international agreements or the net zero accord itself that is the problem. It's been Labor's electricity policies.
But you understand the Paris Agreement to require Australia to have some sort of net zero commitment, because there's a view that it's an international commitment. Australia doesn't have to have a commitment of its own.
Well, it doesn't talk about net zero in those exact terms, but it talks about net zero in a functional sense. So it talks about the offsets.
The other thing the Paris Agreement says, though, is that member countries should be updating and enhancing their targets. Is it possible to stay in Paris if we're backsliding on our targets?
Well, you've also got to have a credible agenda to actually achieve your targets, because at the moment, I don't think many experts are of the belief that Labor will actually get there. And so what you're seeing is higher power prices, industry moving offshore, and frankly, not a great record on decarbonisation. So I think the main game here is Australia is a serious country. We can't repudiate our treaty obligations, and we should maintain a policy to do net zero better than the government. I mean, we can't create our own standards here.
But can we weaken our targets while staying in that treaty?
Well, if you're not going to meet your targets, then you're in a different realm, aren't you?
So you're adamant Australia needs to stay in the Paris Agreement. Can I ask, is this a red line for you?
Well, I mean, how would we leave the Paris Agreement? If we left Paris, we'd be with Azerbaijan, Iran, Syria, you know, and a few other baddies. I mean, Australia has never been with those people before.
So what does this mean for you personally, Andrew Bragg? If there's no commitment of some sort to net zero and no commitment to stay in the Paris Agreement, will you stay on the front bench?
But, I mean, it's not about me. I mean, the Liberal Party historically has had a reputation for fixing things and doing things better than Labor. So I don't think we can give up on it. Our policy has to be to make it actually work. So I'm not really focused on what it means for me. I think we're all in leadership roles, and it's important that we don't give up on things that are hard.
But what would you do?
Well, I don't imagine that Australia is going to be in a grouping with Azerbaijan, Iran and Syria.
But what if that's the decision of your party room? Do you stay on the front bench?
Well, I just don't believe that that's going to happen. I don't think it's in the realm of the possible.
Well, it seems that's the view of many of your colleagues, though. They want to ditch any reference to net zero. We just heard from Sarah Henderson, remove net zero in its entirety.
Well, I mean, I will do the right thing, but my view is that we won't get to that, because I don't believe that my colleagues want Australia to be ranked with those baddies.
What's the right thing? Is that staying on the front bench and changing your view or quitting?
Well, I think you know that that's not on the cards. And
what's
my
not on
view,
the cards?
Well, I'm not going to... I mean, you can't change your fundamental views. I mean, you can't do that. Here are my principles, but I have these ones if you don't like those. I mean, it's pretty much the case that Australia needs to be in Paris, in my opinion, and then we need to try and find a way to do net zero better than Labor, that is better for jobs, better for industry and better for decarbonisation. I mean, the fact is that Labor is trying to do this without nuclear, right? I mean, almost all the G20 countries are doing nuclear. They're trying to do something which is probably impossible according to the Grattan Institute and ANU.
So just to be clear here, when you say you're not going to change your principles, am I right to interpret that as if the party doesn't stay in Paris and some sort of net zero commitment, you'll quit?
Well, sure, but I don't imagine that we would ever leave Paris. I mean, we're a party of government, right? We're not a fringe party. We're not, fringe dwellers. Most Australians want us to play our fair role in terms of emissions reduction. So I just don't think that we're going to be leaving the Paris Agreement.
Do you think dropping net zero brings down power prices?
I think that net zero, if done properly, could reduce power prices and will reduce power prices over time.
But
I think the way that Labor have done it has resulted in higher power prices because of the way that they have played with the energy system. But ultimately, more renewables and a technology agnostic approach where you have more gas and even more coal in the short term and nuclear would have given you lower power prices, more industry and a better story to tell on decarbonisation. But we don't have that in Australia.
Is there going to be investment in new coal, though? Do you see that anywhere?
I think the best you can hope for now, given you can't turn back the clock, is having those assets work for longer. But we should have had more gas. We should have nuclear. We should have more renewables. I mean, it's. I think the story here is that Labor have completely destroyed the net zero agenda. I think they have destroyed or are destroying support for it. And in the long term, we have to do a better job on this because we are a party of government. Australians want action on climate change, but Australians also want to have jobs and industry onshore. I don't think it's a choice.
Well, I mean, Japan has a net zero by 2050 target enshrined in law. Canada has a net zero by 2050 target enshrined in law. The UK, sure. France, South Korea all have their net zero by 2050 targets enshrined in law. Why shouldn't Australia?
But who cares if it's enshrined in law or not? I mean, what matters is the
well,
way
maybe investors
domestic...
do. Maybe investors like that certainty.
But there are a mix of views about how this works across the G20. You don't have to enshrine things in law. What matters are your commitments and having clear policy settings. And the fact is we're trying to do it without nuclear, without much gas. We turned off the coal too soon. I mean, it's been a disaster. And I feel sorry for people that are paying high power prices because of Labor's mismanagement of these energy policies.
You've talked about your own position. What about Susan Lee? If she bows to the National Party position on this, is she done as leader?
But as I've said to you, David, I don't believe that we'll be leaving the Paris Agreement. We're not a fringe party.
All right, but if... OK, but the National Party says the same. The question is, if you abandon net zero, can Susan Lee survive as leader?
Well, I don't think you can have a fatwa on two words. I think that's too silly for words, frankly. And I think, at the end of the day, like, this is the international standard on decarbonisation. So Australia cannot set out its own international standard. What Australia can do is work out its own plan for how it will get to net zero over the medium to long term.
But you're the one saying net zero needs to be there in the policy in some form.
What I'm saying to you is we should do net zero better than Labor. Labor's net zero has been an absolute disaster for everyone in Australia, and we can do it better than them.
But if Susan Lee, as leader, accepts a position that has no net zero reference at all, can she survive as leader?
But, I mean, what do you mean by no reference? I mean,
it's not in the policy at all.
Well, you can't have a fatwa on two words. I mean, it's ridiculous.
So if there is a fatwa on two words, as you put it, what does that mean for the leader?
But you can't have a fatwa on two words. This is the international standard. I mean, trying to pretend that you're not going to say two words is absolutely ridiculous.
But if that absolutely ridiculous position is adopted by your party room, what does that mean for the leader?
But, I mean, I don't see how it can be, because this is the international standard, OK? Australia is part of the international community. It is not actually the net zero accord which is driving higher power prices. It is Labor's disastrous energy policies.
OK. Let's turn to your housing portfolio, Senator. You said something the other day that I don't think I've heard a Liberal politician say before. You want house prices to fall. Why?
I think for entry-level houses, it is very hard for first home or prospective home buyers to get a first house. And I think anyone who's trying to buy a first house knows that it's too expensive. And so I think we should be honest with the Australian people about that reality. Now, the reason that they're so high right now is because Labor have failed to build supply and they have changed the 5% deposit scheme, and that has increased prices by 1.2% in 1 month alone.
Well, I'll come to that. But do you really say to all those who struggled to get their first home, you now want the value of that home to fall?
I think in relation to first home owners, we need to be honest with them and say that house prices are too high at that level. I mean, if you're wanting to buy a first house...
You could leave them in negative equity though, couldn't you?
But if you're wanting to buy a first house, like a flat in the city or a small house in a country town, the house prices are too high. And the government in Canberra is making them too high with their stupid policies. So my job is to be honest about these things. I mean, Claire O'Neill says that there's no problem here. I just think that's ridiculous.
Well, the minister does point out, I think it's 5,778 first-home buyers entered the market using the first-home deposit guarantee in October. Would you rather they were all still renting?
Well, as you know, the government uncapped this scheme. They removed all the means testing and they didn't even model it until July, which was 3 months after they announced the policy. OK? So this has been a reckless change, and I don't believe the taxpayers need to provide support to people who don't, frankly, need that level of support from the Commonwealth Government, and that is bringing forward demand. Don't forget, the government has failed on supply. They have built fewer houses.
Well, I think successive governments have failed on supply over decades. But are you saying these people you'd rather still be renting?
Well, hang on. The last Liberal government built 200,000 houses a year on average. This government's built 170,000 houses a year on average, despite spending $60 billion in rubbish bureaucracy. So they have failed on supply. Then they've brought in this demand-side measure, which is supercharged in 1 month. We've seen the biggest increase in entry-level house prices in years, in one month. So these guys have made a complete mess of housing.
The Cotality report that you're talking about there, it does point to the deposit guarantee as a factor, but the first factor it points to is lower interest rates, as well as persistently higher than average levels of investor activity. Surely you'd agree there's more than just the government's policy here at play. Lower interest rates brings more people into the market.
Well, that report also makes the point that at the higher end, prices aren't changing. So they make the point that the prices are changing at the first home level. That's where the deposit guarantee comes in. It was reckless. I mean, the fact that they didn't even model the changes before they announced it shows how bad they are on housing. The Prime Minister of the country has been using the wrong number. He says it's 0.5% increase over 6 years, which is laughable. It's actually 0.6%.
Now, are you saying any policy then that pumps up demand is a bad idea? And does that include the policy you took to the election to let people dip into their superannuation, take up to $50,000 out to buy a home?
Supply is the main game, and the bulk of our policies will be here on supply. Now, unfortunately, Labor have spent $60 billion to build fewer houses. They've built lots of bureaucracies like the Housing Australia Future Fund, which doesn't build houses.
I'm just asking about demand, though. Sorry, just to come back to the question. It's about whether demand measures are a problem, including what you took to the election on dipping into superannuation.
In isolation from solving the supply challenge, of course, if you only have demand-side policies, you make the problem worse. So we're reviewing all our policies. You can expect to see a full refresh on our housing policies. And I want the Liberal Party to be a party of supply, development and home ownership.
But do you think dipping into super is a good idea or not?
Well, I mean, what do you mean dipping in? I mean,
taking money from your superannuation to buy a home, is that a good idea or not?
Well, that policy has been to two elections. We'll look at whether or not there's any scope to use super in the future. But as it stands, I think it's unlikely we would continue with that exact policy because there might be a better way to do it. But I also want to be very clear with you, David, that we want to be a party of supply, OK? That is so important because you cannot solve the crisis unless you build more houses. So that's going to be our laser focus.
All right. Look, finally, you also told Triple J during the week that politicians should only own one home each. Why is that?
Well, I think there's a bit more context around that, David. But, I mean, my point is that I think politicians shouldn't be tone deaf. This is a crisis for my generation, the millennial generation, and I think people should be conscious that they're in leadership positions and they should take great care, because if people can't buy a house, it is changing the country.
Well, Susan Lee has three investment properties as well as her own home, according to her register. Is that a problem for you?
Look, I'm sure you can go through the register and find people who have got 7 or 8 or 10 houses. My point is, I think people should just be conscious that we're in a housing crisis. I think we are leaders, and generations now are looking down the barrel of never buying a house, so I just think people ought to be careful.
Senator Andrew Bragg, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, David.
We'll have more on the housing front in a moment. Let's get back to the panel. Patricia Karvelas, John Keogh and Jason Katsoukas. PK, just back on net zero.
A fatwa on two words.
There can't be a fatwa on two words. Just firstly, Andrew Bragg finally, I think, has said, of course, he would go.
Of course, I wrote that down. Yes, of course.
So is that a threat that we could see resignations from the front bench this week?
Oh, I think that's absolutely what that is. Look, you know, he hedged. What he also did, though, was try to front-run the debate, right? Basically suggesting that there is no way you can dump net zero. Well, Andrew Bragg, half your party room wants to, right? So it's almost like he had an interview with you on his dream debate, not the reality debate, because they do want to dump the two words. There is a fatwa on the two words. And so there is a real battle going on. He is trying to establish the parameters of that debate to suggest that it is lunacy to even be having it on those terms. But, yeah, when you pushed him, which you did an excellent job of, he had to concede that it was irreconcilable for him to be sitting there as a frontbencher.
Well, he's just said it. Here are my principles. If you don't agree with them, here are another set. You can't do that. Are we likely to see people go one way or another this week?
Well, listening to Andrew, it seems like, yes, we will see people go. I thought it was also interesting how he kept saying we're not a party of the fringe, but yeah. When you look at the electoral map, that's exactly what the Liberal Party is at the moment. And as those comments from Keith Wallahan highlight, that the Liberal Party has become a party of the fringe. They are on the fringe of all of the metropolitan cities, and that's, I think, the real danger, that they will continue to be that if they don't modernise on this and other issues such as women, getting women into parliament, that story.
And when it comes to what they'll do as an alternative energy policy, what we heard there, a bit like Dan Tehan earlier this morning, John, sweat those coal assets longer, more gas as well. Nuclear would be a down-the-track thing. That's not, you know, we can't get that anytime soon. And that's about it.
And maybe tying themselves to some sort of international commitments, the average of OECD like the Nats have, or G20 or something like that. I think that's the direction they might be heading into in terms of future emissions cuts.
But unlike the Nats, he wants more renewables built. He wants more investment in renewables. That is something clearly the Nats do not want.
Absolutely.
Where there is, I think, a difference between those positions too. Look, I think, you know, that was a really significant interview, can I say, in the sort of timeline of the way everyone's positioning ahead of that big Wednesday meeting. He did a few things there, David. He didn't miss. He knew what he was doing. He came in with some pretty hot lines that I'm sure he practiced in the mirror, and I like Andrew Barry a lot. I would have practiced in the mirror too. But
the fatwa line?
The fatwa was gold. Iran, Syria, baddies, right? Like, we don't want to be in this group. They're baddies. They're the, you know, this real binary, the bad countries. Yeah. We are not of that genre. Interesting that he made that point, because the US is also
exactly. Let's call it
he
out.
Didn't mention that baddie. But I thought it was a real sort of... he's trying to galvanise a pushback now. There is a real battle going on inside the Liberal Party over this totemic issue for them.
And he's trying to give the moderates some mettle ahead of what's coming in the next few days.
To give him some credit, right, the moderates have been limp for years. Bragg must be given some credit for being a moderate that's kind of like fighting the good
fight. Come on, guys.
Right?
Yeah, we did see a coordinated push during the week from Bragg, Tim Wilson, there were others as well, who all came out to make their point. So, look, we'll see what that amounts to during the week. Let's turn to the housing market. The latest data we were talking about there from research firm Cotality showed prices did jump 1.1% just in October. It is the biggest jump in more than 2 years. And as Andrew Bragg said, it coincided with the expansion of the government's home deposit guarantee. What does that mean? From October 1, first home buyers, regardless of income, can now access the scheme to buy a property with only a 5% deposit. There's price caps in each market. And then what did we see in October? That jump, the biggest price jumps were, as Andrew Bragg said, for homes in the lower and middle price points of the market. The government, though, denies its new offering is turbocharging the market, arguing it's supply shortages, those lower interest rates and wages that are having a bigger impact.
We do not shy away from that. Our 5% deposit program has, over the course of our government, over more than three and a half years... gotten 197,000 young people into their first home where they otherwise wouldn't have that opportunity.
So, John, has this expanded home deposit guarantee put petrol into the housing market or not? Who's right?
Well, it's early days, but I think you'd have to say the evidence is that it is having an impact. There was 50% more of these government guarantees provided in the month of October than October last year. Prices are up, not just because of this guarantee scheme.
I mean, clearly lower rates.
Yeah. There's all those other factors as a contributing lack of supply and stuff like that. But it's interesting because what the economic research showed from Nicholas Gruen for the insurance industry was that it'll actually push up prices in the short term, in the first year, because it brings forward a whole lot of demand, particularly in those suburbs and price brackets where first home buyers are buying. And we quoted a buyer's agent in the AFR weekend from Brisbane, and he said a really interesting thing. This is not just affecting first home buyers. He said, as soon as the government announced it was expanding, accelerating the scheme in late August, in September, investors jumped in anticipation of first home buyers getting into this scheme in October and pushing up prices. He said prices went up 4 to 7% in some neighbourhoods, in some pockets, in some price brackets, just in that 4-week period alone.
Yeah, that's really interesting. What do you think, Jason? Is the government still, you know, right to be confident about how this is all going?
Well, we have had 3 interest rate cuts this year. I'm sure that is a significant factor when it comes
helps to the first home buyer.
That's right. So it's not clear that this assistance is what is driving up prices. A lot of economists are saying that it is the interest rate cuts that is the primary driver of this increase in house prices that we're seeing.
The battle over housing, though, PK, it was big in the last term. It remains such a challenge for Australia. And it was interesting to hear from Andrew Bragg about where they might be heading as well. Maybe not going with the superannuation policy they've taken to a couple of elections, now focusing more on housing supply as well.
I think that's really fascinating and very smart from Andrew Bragg. I mean, it's hard for him to get some clear air to be articulating these points given the shenanigans in his party. But actually what he's saying is really, I think, politically significant. He wants to move away and he's leading the policy here. You know, he's nemesis in many ways. Michael Sukkar, remember that guy from the right that lost his seat, was the sort of senior housing guy. It was all about demand. Do you remember the sort of, that you could get sort of a deal on your mortgage if you had a new home? That was one of the crazy policies they announced.
Tax deductibility for your principal place of residence mortgage.
The most wild policy idea that most experts thought was the dumbest policy ever. Let's just leave that. Andrew Bragg, he isn't in that camp. He's a smart guy. He's been working on this. He doesn't want to be basically inflating house prices. And he knows that he has to be consistent. So if he's criticising Labor for inflating house prices with this policy, can't be then saying, hey, get your super. I spoke to him this week and he actually, you know, pretty much said the policy was dead.
Well, that's what I remember. He was a little more cautious.
Or maybe
there.
Someone yelled at him or something.
Surprising, because I thought philosophically he really believed in superannuation for housing. I mean, he's not a big fan of the compulsory and industry superannuation industry. Yeah, so I thought it was a policy he was actually pretty wedded to.
He was strong on my show, though, saying that he doesn't believe in it. It's because of the impact on house prices. It's not because he doesn't think you should have access to your super to do whatever you want with it. So I think philosophically he still is in favour of your access.
You can't bag the government for, you know, pumping up house prices with this measure on the 5% guarantee and then offer to let people take 50
grand. No, because people like me say, what are you talking about? Look, so you can't stand that up.
On interest rates, it was, you know, to nobody's surprise, the Reserve Bank kept rates on hold during the week. But what the Reserve Bank also did was update its inflation forecast. And I want to show you this. The yellow line here is the new forecast from the Reserve Bank. The red line is the old forecast. And you can see the underlying inflation rate now expected to remain slightly higher through next year before returning to the middle of the Reserve Bank's target band. John, what's the reason for that slightly higher inflation?
Well, inflation in the September quarter was higher, and so they've sort of updated their forecast and said it's going to be underlying terms about 3.2% for the first half of next year, which is above the band. They say a lot of this they're hoping is temporary, things like fuel, international travel, council rates. But Michelle Bullock also says she's taking some signal from this. In other words, some of this could be persistent. And in particular, housing construction costs, which goes to the interesting conversation we were just having about housing, that's up partly because of wages and shortage of materials in the sector and things like that, capacity constraints in the economy to build homes. But also the other thing the RBA is pointing to is what's known as market services. And this is things like dining out at restaurants where wages are a large share of the cost of a business. Now, previously, when inflation was coming down, businesses were absorbing those higher costs because there wasn't much consumer demand. They didn't feel confident to pass on those high costs. Now I've had those 3 rate cuts. People are starting to spend a little bit more.
They're eating
businesses,
out
we're going out to restaurants again. We're dining a bit more. We're prepared to pay slightly higher prices. Businesses are feeling a bit more confident about passing those costs on.
And the opposition was saying, well, this is largely government spending that's to blame for pushing up inflation. And that drew a pretty sharp rebuke from the Treasurer.
It gives me a welcome opportunity to point out an egregious lie that was being pushed around the gallery this morning on morning media by the Leader of the Opposition.
That's sparked quite a back and forth over you're a liar, and they've all had to withdraw. But is there evidence to show government spending is pushing up inflation?
Well, it's one of these endlessly contestable arguments, isn't it?
Depends who you ask.
Says no, Ted O'Brien says yes. But I do think Jim Chalmers looked a bit grim this week. I think there was a headline, in fact, Grim Jim or something, perhaps a piece from Dennis Shanahan this week, and he has looked a bit more concerned this week about inflation. And
he was keen to point out, though, the Reserve Bank is not laying the blame at the moment on government spending.
I mean, he's right on the facts, right? That is not what Michelle Bullock said, like it wasn't said. So he's right. But I think there is an issue, though, that the government is well aware of, that their own spending perhaps is part of the story, not all of the story. And, you know, MyFO's coming up. They're having to prepare the next budget. They're actually going to have to start making some tough
spending
decisions.
Spending has been rising, John.
You can't point to a point pushing up the quarterly inflation number for 1 3-month period, sure. In fact, public demand was coming off a bit of that because some of the infrastructure projects are winding down. Public consumption, recurrent spending, is actually very high still at the federal and state level. This year, 27% of GDP federal spend. That's the highest since the late 1980s. I think it is contributing to the persistence inflation, but you wouldn't say that it contributed predominantly to this single quarterly spike in inflation.
Yeah, okay, good point. Look, I want to just circle back to the Libs for a moment because there's been another interesting issue running apart from the whole net zero saga. Andrew Hastie, he copped a fair bit of criticism for the comment that he made just over a week ago about Priya's Law. There was a debate over Priya's Law, which is about providing paid parental leave to mums who suffer either a stillbirth or an infant death. Here's what he said.
And I note the sensitivity around this, but I do call upon the government to clarify that it does not apply to late-term abortions.
It took a week for Susan Lee to say anything publicly about it, but when she did, here it was.
As a mother and a grandmother, this is very personal. So any commentary about this bill applying in other contexts is insensitive.
PK Andrew Hastie says he was being sensitive. He was just raising the question, but even raising that question about whether someone might have a late-term abortion so they can access paid parental leave, it really upset a lot of women, and including his colleagues.
It certainly did. His female colleagues, I can tell you, privately and even publicly, I think I had a couple of them on the record this week, were red hot with rage about it. There's lots of reasons for that. Interestingly, his friend and ally, James Patterson, defended not the view necessarily, but the tone he used. Now, I think he used, fine tone, but it's not a tonal issue, David. It's firstly untrue and insensitive in that it kind of it really raises issues that are not, you know, not relevant and are hurtful. But also, can I just talk politics? Because that's why you invited me here. Like, beyond the warm and fuzzy women feelings, I am also a woman, so I'm also a little disturbed by this debate. But since when in Australia is it useful to be talking at a federal level about abortion? Like, do they need to see the research?
Well, Peter Dutton got this.
It's dangerous.
He pushed down any, when Jacinda Nabajibba Price was talking abortion before the election, he made it clear that was not on. And clearly they have a problem in winning back female voters. So, yeah,
it is diabolical. And Andrew Hastie sees himself as a future leader, right? And I think he's got many good attributes, to be honest. I think he has lots of strengths.
Yep.
But I think this stuff will end up dogging him if he doesn't think more carefully about it.
Look, finally, I just wanted to note the death of Graham Richardson as well. He died yesterday morning. One of the most powerful and most influential figures, certainly in the New South Wales right of the Labor Party that they've ever seen. State Secretary, then he goes into the Senate, Minister in the Hawke and Keating cabinets in various roles. Particularly his achievements in environment have been noticed on the Daintree and Kakadu. But look, as the ultimate numbers man, helping Hawke into the job, then helping Keating into the job to topple Hawke. After politics, a big role in the media, of course. Famous on election nights at Channel 9 and at Sky News for many years. I did countless election nights with Richo. I got to say, extraordinary ability to read the numbers, to call it early, but also just to call when someone was done politically as well. There was no one quite like him. As he famously said, the mob will always work you out. He was, I can attest, also very good at the long lunch. I didn't have enough of those.
I'm shocked. Look, no one can count like that guy. He's good at counting, this dude.
Yeah.
He was quite an amazing guy, and actually a very good mentor too in my time at Sky too. He was always really encouraging of young talent coming up, and had really a very good personal approach too, and that's why I think so many people love him. But yeah, like a giant of the Labor movement.
Yeah, and look, as the PM said too, he wasn't perfect. There were the scandals, there were the controversies, all of that. But yeah, on a personal note, wonderful to work with him. My thoughts with Amanda and the family as well. Condolences for the loss. All right, our panel, Jason Katsoukas, John Keogh and Patricia Karvelas. Time for some final observations. A couple of quick ones from me. Firstly, I had a great chat with Nikki Savva and Troy Bramston for the podcast this week to mark the 50th anniversary of The Dismissal, which is on Tuesday. Troy's written a terrific book about Gough Whitlam. Nikki was there on the day it all happened, and there's a full day of events at Old Parliament House on Tuesday to mark the anniversary, which will include a screening of an interview between Nikki and Paul Keating. Greg Jennett also has a terrific documentary on the 50th anniversary of The Dismissal. That airs tonight at 8:30pm on the ABC News Channel. Don't miss that. And a big shout-out and thank you to Sam Clark, who, after 7.5 years running this program as executive producer, has been promoted to managing editor of national news for the ABC. There he is at the Garma Festival. On behalf of us all, thank you, Sam, for the extraordinary work you've done for this program and for our awesome audience, steering us through COVID, election campaigns and various political crises. A loss to this program, but I'm glad you'll still be our boss. Let's get some final observations, Jason.
Jane Hume, the Liberal senator from Victoria, made a lot of news in the lead-up to the election campaign by saying that the coalition would take away work from home rights for Commonwealth public servants. And she copped a lot of criticism for that. I thought she might be done with that issue, but over the last few weeks she's been asking a lot of very forensic questions of government departments and agencies about how much work from home is happening in those agencies and departments. So perhaps Jane Hume has more to say on this issue.
Interesting. John.
David, Napoleon purportedly said, never interrupt your enemy when he's making a mistake, and Labor appears to have adopted that mindset amid the coalition infighting on climate and energy policy. But as one observer said to me this week, the risk for the country more generally is that Labor continues this more sort of cautious, small target approach and just keeps winning elections based on looking more stable and competent than the coalition, when really what we need to be tackling is some of the bigger economic and other policy changes and reforms to improve people's living standards.
Yeah, fair enough. PK.
So some Conservatives are livid with Sarah Henderson for her intervention, which was not authorised and not according to plan. Some are threatening her pre-selection. They're talking up Rashina Campbell, who actually was on my show on Friday and contributed really interestingly, I think, to this debate, who is still, you know, got an appetite, I think, to go into politics at sort of a federal level. She's doing the Melbourne job. But I just think that's interesting that there are consequences for the way that that played out. And final comment from me, yes to Sam Clark, who ran this show for so long. You know, it's a hard show. As you know, David, as the host, I've filled in many times. You know, takes out your weekend. You don't see your kids at the most important times, and he's done a brilliant job. So want to thank him on behalf of all the people who've worked on this show.
He'll still be further up the ladder, but gets his weekends back, which is yes. Terrific. Thank you all very much for joining us this morning. Finally, Liberal Senator Jess Collins gave a stirring speech during the week about the profound impact former Howard Government Minister Richard Alston had on superannuation. And she dropped a bombshell revelation, which came as something of a surprise to the 83-year-old. We'll leave you with that. Thanks for watching.
The significant contributions of the late Senator Richard Alston in the early 1990s. If anybody had the privilege of listening to the condolence speeches to the late Senator Richard Alston just a few months ago, I indeed exaggerated his death. I can confirm that former Senator Richard Alston AO is A-OK. Having spoken to him immediately after my speech, to apologise for my mistake.
You're making us all feel very excited about being here.